Good morning. The birth of a Brown family tradition came on an ordinary summer day while canoeing on Hamlin Lake. We were in the middle of our annual camping trip to Ludington State Park in Michigan. My brother and my dad had rented a canoe and were paddling the perimeter of the rather large lake when they discovered an inlet. So they paddled in, exploring, hoping maybe to see a heron or an eagle. But what they saw instead was much more unexpected. Just beyond the shore, back in the woods, there were people walking around. This was unexpected because there were no hiking trails in this part of the park. There were no landmarks indicated on the map that would make this part of the forest a destination. And yet, these people didn't appear to be lost. In fact, they seemed to be there on purpose and were looking at something with excitement. So the next day, we hiked as a family to the same section of woods that my dad and brother had seen from the canoe in the inlet the day before. Leaving the trail behind, we wandered through a forest that appeared to have had no human interference. There were old trees and animal burrows and a healthy chipmunk population. There were fallen trees that had been rotting for so long you could pick them apart with your hands. The inlet was a sheltered haven housing frogs and turtles and herons. The woods were quiet, muting the noise of vacationing families enjoying the more popular parts of the park. It was a type of place you could easily assume very few people had ever been before. The type of place where you might wonder if you were the first human to ever stand in this exact spot. Except for one glaring detail. In the middle of this remote, forgotten, hidden section of forest, there were the ruins of several large buildings. The building material making up the walls and roofs had either rotted or been removed, but the foundations were still almost perfectly intact. What they were, what they were for, or how long they'd been there, we didn't know. There was no plaque, no sign. It wasn't listed in the visitor brochure. Whatever had been here had long since been forgotten. We later discovered through some research and some helpful conversations with some helpful park rangers that what we had discovered was the location of a thriving Girl Scout camp in the 1930s and 1940s. It's called Camp Lucy Mack. It had been a long time since it had been operational, and the forest had reclaimed the ground it once shared with hundreds of summer residents. We loved this little discovery our family had made, and it felt like our own private piece of an otherwise very popular park. And so every year, in the middle of our annual trip to Ludington State Park, we would get up early and hike to the Girl Scout camp for breakfast. We'd sit on the old foundations, eating our cereal and granola bars, and imagine what used to take place in these same woods. We wandered among the ruins, exploring. We found the wells that they dug, found the fire pit where they gathered around and sang songs. We tried to recreate the buildings in our minds by the clues left in the foundations. The fireplace was over here. There's pipes coming up over there. But it was all guesswork, imagining the forgotten stories of the ruins in the forest. The prophet Isaiah tells us a similar story in chapter 5 of his book. That's where we're at this morning, Isaiah chapter 5. I want to speak these words into your hearing. Would you stand with me in honor of God's word this morning? Isaiah 5, 1 through 7. Let me sing for my beloved, my love song concerning his vineyard. My beloved had a vineyard on a very fertile hill. He dug it and cleared it of stones and planted it with choice vines. He built a watchtower in the midst of it and hewed out a wine vat in it. And he looked for it to yield grapes, but it yielded wild grapes. And now, O inhabitants of Jerusalem and men of Judah, judge between me and my vineyard. What more was there to do for my vineyard that I have not done on it? When I looked for it to yield grapes, why did it yield wild grapes? And now I will tell you what I will do to my vineyard. I will remove its hedge. It shall be devoured. I will break down its wall, and it shall be trampled down. I will make it a waste. It shall not be pruned or hoed, and briars and thorns shall grow up. I will also command the clouds that they rain no rain upon it. For the vineyard of the Lord of hosts is the house of Israel, and the men of Judah are his pleasant planting. And he looked for justice, but behold, bloodshed, for righteousness, but behold, an outcry. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. You can be seated. It's likely that this passage sounds somewhat familiar to you for a number of reasons. First, the theme of vineyard and vine dresser is pervasive in the scriptures, including in the earlier chapters of Isaiah that we've already looked at, and then in the book of John, which was our sermon series before the book of Isaiah. But also, this passage resembles the voice and the structure of the parables of Jesus in the New Testament. In fact, there are a few parables that borrow heavily from the imagery of this poetic prophecy in Isaiah. The parable of the tenants in Matthew chapter 21 is a direct callback to Isaiah chapter 5. So while this isn't identified specifically as a parable, it is fulfilling a lot of the same functions of a parable. Isaiah is telling a story through a song to help his audience understand the character of God in relation to their actions. So as we begin this morning, I just want to do a brief flyover of the entire story so we're all on the same page about the structure and the storyline, and then we'll go back and draw out some of the main concepts and truths I think Isaiah is communicating here. He starts out in verse 1. He says, "Let me sing for my beloved my song concerning his vineyard." Now, it's not abundantly clear who he's talking about here. This could be a relative or a good friend, or he could be borrowing the language of beloved from Song of Solomon. What does seem to be clear is that he's serving as the narrator to tell us about someone else's vineyard. He's giving us the facts. It's very objective in the beginning of his song. My beloved had a vineyard on a very fertile hill. He dug it and cleared it of stones, and he planted it with choice vines. He built a watchtower in the midst of it and hewed out a wine vat in it. So the owner of this vineyard has worked very hard and very carefully to build and produce not just a vineyard, but a good vineyard. He's done everything right. He's gotten rid of potential barriers to a vineyard being fruitful. He's cleared it of stones. He's chosen the best vines to plant. He's taken steps to protect it and care for it, and he's prepared to maintain this vineyard for a long time. He's dug a wine vat. He's expecting it to produce fruit. The stage is set. A faithful gardener who's done everything right to ensure a fruitful vineyard. And then the plot twist. And he looked for it to yield grapes, but it yielded wild grapes. After all of that work, the vineyard failed. The vine dresser did everything right, but the vineyard failed him. We're only two verses in, so we're not very emotionally invested yet, but can you imagine just for a minute how disappointing this would be? After all the work the vine dresser has done, the whole project appears to be a massive failure, and it seems that Isaiah wants his audience to understand this. He switches voices, and now the song is coming from the owner of the vineyard. It's not a friend talking anymore, who's somewhat emotionally removed from the loss. Now it's the vine dresser himself speaking with pretty raw emotion about how his vineyard that he gave so much that's failing him. Verse 3, "And now, O inhabitants of Jerusalem and men of Judah, judge between me and my vineyard. What more was there to do for my vineyard that I have not done in it? When I looked for it to yield grapes, why did it yield wild grapes?" The rhetorical question proves his point. What more was there to do? Nothing. So what can be done? Well, he tells us, verse 5, "And now I will tell you what I will do to my vineyard. I will remove its hedge, and it shall be devoured. I will break down its wall, and it shall be trampled down. I will make it a waste. It shall not be pruned or hoed, and briars and thorns shall grow up. I will also command the clouds that they rain no rain upon it. Have you ever worked on a project for a long time and it just completely flopped? And you get to the end and out of frustration, you just start justifying why you're going to completely abandon the project? Like, you know what, honey? I think the house looks better without Christmas lights, right? Like, I know we were going to put up Christmas lights and we spent all day trying to put up Christmas lights. But like, if you just look at it, it looks pretty festive as is. You know, like, honestly, Christmas lights would be overkill, right? That's not what's happening here. Okay, in grief and sorrow, he's disassembling what he created because it's useless. He's not grasping at straws for justification. He already has it. It didn't do what it was supposed to do. After everything I did, it didn't do what it was supposed to do. And so I'm done. I'm not going to pour out my energy into a fruitless vineyard. I'm going to let it be destroyed. We are meant to feel the loss here. I think Isaiah switches voices to the first person to help us resonate with how personal this betrayal really is. And then he switches back to the narrator to explain the song. Verse 7. For the vineyard of the Lord of hosts is the house of Israel, and the men of Judah are his pleasant planting, and he looked for justice, but behold, bloodshed, for righteousness, but behold, an outcry. I wish every text in the Bible had a verse 7 like this. Here's what it means. This is what it's about. The owner of the vineyard is God. The vineyard is Israel and the promised land that God brought them into. The people of Israel are the fruit. They're supposed to be good fruit, but they're not. They're supposed to look a certain way and act a certain way, but behold, they are acting completely differently. This is a personal affront and betrayal to God, and so he's going to destroy them. The end. What a sweet song. Well, it's the end of the song. It's not the end of what we can learn from it, okay? I think there's some specific things we can see here about the character of God and his posture towards us. Some things we can see about the rebellion of his people and the fallout of that, and then what we do with all of that. First thing that we learn from the story is about a good God deserving worship. We know that the owner of the vineyard represents God. And so the attitude and character and behavior of the owner towards his vineyard helps us understand the attitude and character and behavior of God towards his people. Specifically, I think we see three things about God here that should lead us to worship. First, we see his careful provision of his people. Look at verse 2 and the care that he put into cultivating a fruitful vineyard. The vine dresser didn't inherit the vineyard. He built it from scratch, in a place where there previously wasn't a vineyard. He cleared the land, and you can be sure he didn't have the luxury of a John Deere tractor to help him. We're meant to be reminded here of the accounts of Joshua when God brought Israel into the promised land and cleared the land of potential barriers to his people being fruitful, namely all the pagan nations who lived there, and he planted them in a place where they could thrive. Israel's history is rocky and complicated, but thread throughout the whole story, from the very beginning, is Jehovah Jireh, the God who provides. He provided a substitutionary sacrifice for Abraham on Mount Moriah. He provided manna in the desert. He provided a way through the Jordan River. He provided victory in battle. He provided a home for his chosen people. And this is driven home by the question in verse 4, what more was there to do for my vineyard that I have not done for it? The outcome is not a result of carelessness on the part of the vine dresser. Israel's unfaithfulness is not because God has let them down. He's provided everything that they need. But he didn't stop there. He also protected them. He provided for them and he protected them. Again, look at verse 2. He built a watchtower to guard the vineyard from intruders. Verse 5 reveals that he also built a hedge and a wall that kept people out. Again, we're meant to think of the rich history of Israel and the continual protection of God that he provided. Israel should have been annihilated countless times. But again and again and again, God protected them. He ensured that they would remain where he planted them. Israel's history is rocky and complicated, but thread throughout the whole story, from the very beginning, is Jehovah Magineinu, God our defender. He brought them through the Red Sea and buried the Egyptians with their chariots. When the Syrian army surrounded the city where Elisha dwelt, Elisha knew that those who are with us are more than those who are with them. When the entire nation trembled at the threats of a giant, David knew that the Lord who delivered me from the paw of the lion and the paw of the bear, he'll deliver me from this Philistine, who I won't even name. So we can see why the vine dresser in the story is so hurt by the state of his vineyard. God had provided everything the Israelites needed and protected them again and again. They should have been worshiping him nonstop. But instead, they were crediting their provision and protection to idols and gods that they had created. And so God says, okay, I'm going to remove my provision and my protection. You've rejected it, and so I'm taking it away. Verse 5, and now I will tell you what I will do to my vineyard. I will remove its hedge, and it shall be devoured. I will break down its wall, and it shall be trampled down. There goes the protection. Verse 6, I will make it a waste. It shall not be pruned or hoed, and briars and thorns shall grow up. I will also command the clouds that they rain no rain upon it. There goes the provision. God removes his provision and protection, and the result is desolation. When God removes his provision and protection, the result is desolation. So the question then is this: are you desolate this morning? Is your life and home destroyed and left in waste? If not, it is because you are actively benefiting from the provision and protection of God. You are right now standing in grace. You're sitting in grace. I'm standing in grace. But who is it that you credit that provision? Who do you worship? Only one is deserving of it. The text shows us a good God deserving worship. Yet the people of Israel were not producing worshipful fruit, which resulted in judgment, but not right away. This good God doesn't just provide and protect. He's also patient. We see this a little bit in Isaiah 5, just by looking at the time and the care he took to plant and build the vineyard. He was patient to get the fruit that he wanted. But we see this even more clearly when we look at some of the parables in the New Testament that elaborate on this passage. I mentioned Matthew 21 earlier. I'm going to look at Matthew 21, starting in verse 33. This is what it says. Hear another parable. There was a master of a house who planted a vineyard and put a fence around it and dug a wine press in it and built a tower. Sound familiar? Same story. And he leased it to tenants and went into another country. When the season for fruit drew near, he sent his servants to the tenants to get his fruit. And the tenants took his servants and beat one, killed another, and stoned another. Again, he sent other servants, more than the first, and they did the same to them. Finally, he sent his son to them, saying, "They will respect my son." But when the tenants saw the son, they said to themselves, "This is the heir. Come, let us kill him and have his inheritance." And they took him and threw him out of the vineyard and killed him. When therefore the owner of the vineyard comes, what will he do to those tenants? They said to him, "He will put those wretches to a miserable death and let out the vineyard to other tenants who will give him the fruits in their seasons." And Jesus goes on in this passage to reveal that he's actually talking about Israel and their unfaithfulness, even after God sent prophets and teachers to help them. But the question lingering after Jesus tells this parable isn't, is God really justified to destroy those tenants? Of course he is. That's not the question. The question is, why did he wait so long? Why didn't he do it sooner? Why did he keep sending more servants when they had killed the ones before? Why did he keep sending more prophets when they had rejected the ones before? Why has he kept giving you and me opportunities to repent and give our life to him when he could have just wiped his hands of us and been done with us a long time ago? Because he's a patient God. Because what he told Moses on Mount Sinai is still true. The Lord, Yahweh, a God merciful and gracious, slow to anger, and abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness. He provides, he protects, and he's patient. This is a good God deserving worship. But the Israelites were not worshiping. Despite the care of a perfect gardener, the vineyard was producing bad fruit. Despite his patience, They refused to surrender. They rejected him and ran after their own idols and interests. They were a rebellious people earning judgment. Kids, how many kids are here this morning? Raise your hand if you're a kid or wish you were. Kids, have you ever been in trouble with your parents and you knew they were right? Like, there's a lot of times where you're in trouble and you think, I really feel like my siblings should be in trouble and not me. But then there's those other times where you get in trouble and you're like, yep, they're right. I definitely did something I wasn't supposed to, and I'm getting what I deserve. That's what's going on here. The judgment the Israelites are about to receive is not unfair. They are getting exactly what they deserve. Let me show you. Verse 2 says, and he looked for it to yield grapes, but it yielded wild grapes. Wild grapes here could be translated stinking grapes or worthless grapes. Think of the fruit that you left in the basket a little too long and it turns rancid. It has no use. But I think this is really interesting. They're still producing fruit. When I read this passage for the first time, I expected verse 2 to say, and he looked for it to yield grapes, but it did not. Like, Israel's supposed to be living a certain way, and they're not. They're not producing fruit. But instead, the passage says they are producing fruit. It's just undesirable fruit. Very undesirable fruit. Here's a side note. This is for free. Everyone is producing fruit. The question is, what fruit are you producing? Can the people around you tell who you're worshiping by the fruit that you produce? Not here, not Israel. Everything was set up perfectly for them to produce healthy fruit. Verse 2 says, my beloved had a vineyard on a very fertile hill. The conditions were perfect. They had everything they needed to live in harmony with God and live lives that pleased him. But instead, they produce undesirable fruit. What fruit did they produce? Look at verse 7. For the vineyard of the Lord of hosts is the house of Israel, and the men of Judah are his pleasant planting. And he looked for justice, but behold, bloodshed. For righteousness, but behold, an outcry. The fruit that they produced was the exact opposite of the fruit that they were supposed to produce. They were supposed to produce justice. They're supposed to care for the vulnerable. But instead, they're killing innocent people and hurting people to get ahead. They're supposed to live righteous lives that were above reproach, but instead, their behavior is a shameful outcry. The definition here refers to a cry that attends anarchy and covetousness. They're not just a little off course. The fruit of this vineyard is the exact opposite of the fruit that the vine dresser planted. But to be honest with you, as bad as that sounds, the weight of this verse is entirely lost in the English translation. This is actually a brilliant play on words. The Hebrew word for justice here is mishpat. Everybody say mishpat. And the word for righteousness is tzedakah. Say tzedakah. In contrast, the word for bloodshed is mispah, and the word for outcry is tziaka. Say mispah and tziaka. Very good. So the text actually reads this way. And he looked for mishpat, but behold mispah, for tzedakah, but behold tziaka. And it's meant to do exactly what it just did in your hearing. The obvious poetry stands out. If the first six verses were getting dry and you were beginning to fade, the ingenious wordplay here captures the attention and clearly articulates the justification for judgment. But what's also fascinating here is that he doesn't just declare judgment. He invites them to declare judgment on themselves. Look at verse 3 and 4. And now, O inhabitants of Jerusalem and men of Judah, judge between me and my vineyard. What more was there to do for my vineyard that I have not done for it? When I looked for it to yield grapes, why did it yield wild grapes? They don't know yet that the song is about them. And God speaks through Isaiah and says, hey, what's the play here? You tell me. Has the vine dresser done enough? Is he justified in destroying the vineyard? What do you think? He invites their input because the verdict is clear and even the guilty cannot argue with it. This is a rebellious people who have earned judgment. And so, they will receive it. Verse 5, I will tell you what I'll do with my vineyard. I will remove its hedge and it shall be devoured. I will break down its wall. It will be trampled down. I will make it a waste. It shall not be pruned or hoed, and briars and thorns shall grow up. And I will also command the clouds that they rain no rain upon it. The promised land that I've prepared for you and brought you into, this space that is meant for your thriving, will be taken away. And everything that you've built here will be destroyed. All right, that's it. Let me send you with a benediction. No, we can't end there. But that's where the text ends. Fortunately, Isaiah doesn't leave us hanging. He gives us a little more in a nearby text. In chapter 1 of Isaiah, we find one of his oracles of prophecy about this same judgment that's coming to Israel. Chapter 1, verse 7-9. Your country lies desolate. Your cities are burned with fire. In your very presence, foreigners devour your land. It is desolate as overthrown by foreigners. Does this sound familiar? Foreigners devour your land. Think Isaiah 5, verse 5, it shall be devoured. Or back in chapter 1, it is desolate. Think Isaiah 5, 6, I will make it a waste. Same judgment. But continue on back in chapter 1, verse 8. And the daughter of Zion is left like a booth in a vineyard. Like a what? Like a lodge in a cucumber field. Like a besieged city. If the Lord of hosts had not left us a few survivors, we should have been like Sodom and become like Gomorrah. So they are desolate and destroyed, but not all the way. God is going to preserve a small remnant of the people who will not be destroyed. They are left as a hopeful assurance that this place of thriving will be rebuilt. He is still being patient. He is still providing and protecting. Even while he declares his judgment, he shows glimpses of his merciful redemption. And what image does he use to communicate this hopeful alternative ending? Ruins in a vineyard. Remember that vineyard that was destroyed? Not all the way. The walls are gone, but the foundation is still intact, and it can be rebuilt. It can bear good fruit yet. Against all odds, this is a redemptive story giving hope. Last summer, on my sabbatical, I returned with my family to Ludington State Park for the first time in about a decade. And in the middle of our week there, I took a hike with my dad and my brothers and my daughter to the overgrown ruins of a Girl Scout camp in a forgotten part of the forest. A place designed for people, especially children, to thrive, that has been broken down, disassembled, and forgotten. But not all the way. As my daughter went down to the inlet with her uncles to see the frogs and turtles, I sat on the ruins of an old building eating a granola bar, and it was clear that the story of Camp Lucy Mack is not yet over. It no longer houses hundreds of summer residents, but on that July morning, there was at least one little girl who was chasing chipmunks and throwing sticks in the inlet, who was thriving in every sense of the word. I doubt the Girl Scout camp will ever be rebuilt. It could be. The foundations are still there. But there are no promises in the Bible about Camp Lucy Mack. But there are promises in the Bible about the character of a God who has a track record of redeeming even the worst stories to a hopeful end. Maybe I should say that again. There are promises in the Bible about the character of a God who has a track record of redeeming even the worst stories to a hopeful end. Let me just close by saying this. I don't know where you're at this morning. I don't know your relationship with God or the things going on in your life, but your story is not yet over. No matter what the chapters have held so far, there is time yet for a hopeful end. But there's only one author who can write that story. I'd love to introduce you to him. His name is Jesus, and he turns ruins into riches. Let's pray. Loving Father, if you had not been patient, our stories would not have a redemptive plot twist. we would not be here. We would not have hope. But you have been patient. You have been long-suffering with our worthless, stinking fruit, and you have enabled us with the help of your Spirit to produce healthy fruit. So knowing what we deserve, seeing with fresh eyes this morning how dependent we are on you, we want to declare that you are a good God, deserving our worship. Worship in the way we live our lives, worship in our thoughts, but for now, in this moment, worship through lifting our voice in song. So be glorified now. I pray in the name of Jesus. Amen.